call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, February 23rd, and we are convened for the purposes of a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bills 610, 611, 624, 655, Senate Bill 14, potential work session, and Senate Bill 110. Just to give everybody a sense of how things will progress today, we're going to open up public hearings on 610, 11, and 24 simultaneously. So when you want to come and present on a particular bill, just identify which one you're talking about at each particular moment. And then we will close the public hearing on those bills. Then we'll have a hearing on 655, and none of those bills are ready to move today. And I think what we'll what we are going to do on Senate Bill 14 is roll that one over. We should be getting an amendment on that.
For 14?
Yeah.
We might have it by the end of the meeting, so if we want to wait until the end of the meeting to we can just roll it over now would be fine too.
Yeah, I just wanted to give those who might be waiting till the end a heads up that we don't plan on moving Senate Bill 14 today.
Do you want to do 110 or
110? And 110's ready to go?
Yeah, do you want to do that to start?
Does anybody need to testify?
No, they're here in the room in case there's some questions.
Okay,
fiscal for 14
right.
Just came in.
Oh, we just got the fiscal for 14.
Okay. All right, so I think what we'll do is we don't have a public hearing open right now on these bills. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 110. Patrick, can you tell us where we are?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to. Senate Bill 110, we heard this last Monday on the 14th. This is the measure that allows the Employment Department to notify agents of employing units of unemployment insurance benefits claims or denial of claims. There's an emergency clause on this measure. There was a discussion of possibly having consideration of some amendments, but Senator George decided not to go forward with drafting amendments, so the measure is as it was before the committee. There's no fiscal or revenue impact to this measure, and there's representatives from the Employment Department in the room if the committee has any questions.
Okay, but nobody is interested in testifying on this, correct? Okay.
Correct.
Great. So we are in work session. Senator Bonamici, would you make a motion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 110 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici has moved Senate Bill 110 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll, Debbie?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Excused.
And Chair Shields.
Aye. Motion passes. Let's see. Senator Boquist, would you be the carrying this?
Delighted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Boquist will be the carrier. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 110, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bills 610, 611, and 624. Give us a moment till we decide who to call up first. All right, good. At this point, I'll bring up Michael Dale and Kate Newhall, followed by Jan Meekums and J.L. Wilson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Shields, members of the committee. My name is Michael Dale. I'm with the Northwest Workers Justice Project, but I'm here representing the Coalition to Stop Wage Theft in Oregon. As the committee knows, there is a package of bills, of which these three bills are a part, that aim to give agencies and individuals better tools to be able to protect themselves against the epidemic of wage theft in the economy today. Wage theft is when I use that term, what I'm talking about is I'm talking about when someone doesn't pay overtime when it's due. I'm talking about somebody that doesn't get the minimum wage. I'm talking about someone who is promised wages and doesn't get paid. I'm talking about someone whose tips are taken at the till and not paid as they're required to be. There isn't strong research that's been done. There's been some research done, but there isn't strong research that's been done as to the extent of the problem in Oregon, but we do know from the cases that we see, from the clients that we handle, and from the members of the coalition that it's a serious problem in Oregon. We know that nationally it's a very serious problem. Studies show that, for example, a substantial number of surveyed workers, low-wage workers, in the previous period of time were in fact not paid all that they were due and had in reported wage theft problems in the prior period. And I've got the details of that in my testimony. So that's kind of the backdrop of why these bills are here. And I want to now turn to Senate Bill 610, which deals with contracted and contingent workers and basically explain what this bill does in broad terms, and then I'd be happy to, of course, respond to any questions the committee has. Fundamentally, what we're trying to get at here is a problem in the economy with contracted and contingent work. And by contingent work, what we're talking about, it's kind of a wonky labor economist term that's not very self-explanatory, but what we're talking about here is people who are in the labor force full-time but are not attached in any kind of permanent way to a job on a full-time basis. So they may be working for subcontractors. They may be working for a temporary agency. They may be standing on the side of the road trying to get paid. They may be misclassified as independent contractors when in fact, under the law, they should be regarded to be employees. This first bill deals with ways of getting at that problem. It does this in actually four ways. The first is that it re-regulates the temporary employment agency industry. Oregon has a system of regulating temporary employment agencies. The only thing is, with changes in the economy and amendments to the statute, it applies to hardly anyone. Basically, one is exempt from that statute so long as the agency doesn't charge an individual worker money for the job referral. Typically now, it isn't the employee who pays, it's the employer who pays. And so hardly anybody falls within its terms anymore. What this bill does is changes that, eliminates that exemption, and requires temporary employment agencies to register with BOLI, post a bond to secure unpaid wages, and do some things that are sort of housekeeping things. When you dispatch someone, you give them a written dispatch that specifies what the terms of employment are going to be. What are you going to get paid? How long are you going to work? What are the hours going to be? Where are you going to work? Those kinds of things. It prohibits charging for transportation, prohibits charging for tools that are necessary for the work, tools or equipment, supplies. And if you provide other kinds of services or so forth to the employee, that you only charge the actual cost of those. So that's, in a nutshell, the first part of what the bill does. The second part is regulation of day labor. Day labor is a form of temporary employment, but it's a shorter form. It's people that are employed for a very short period of time. In that case, though day labor services agencies would be employment agencies and would be required to register under the statute, they have some additional responsibilities that include, for example, that if someone is transported to a job during the day, they, unless they indicate otherwise, have to be transported back to the point of hire, that, again, you get the disclosure statements, you get a wage stub when you get paid, can't charge for tools, can't charge for food, and some of those kinds of things. Those details are in the bill. The bill is drafted by LC, is not very well integrated, and in the materials that I gave you is sort of a not blessed by LC redraft of the bill that we're working on getting redrafted. But I think that to understand how the bill works and so forth, it would be easier to understand referring to that rather than the draft bill itself. And it needs some additional work. A couple other things the bill does is it says that if someone contracts for services in certain industries and is a reasonable business person knows or should know that the amount of money that they're putting into the contract can't possibly cover minimum legal wages and working conditions, then that person becomes jointly and severally liable with the contractor for any unpaid wages that occur. And then finally, it provides that a person who uses contingent work, and that contingent worker is doing exactly the same job as someone else that's a permanent employee, if there's a difference in responsibility or showing the other person how to do it or that kind of thing, you can differentiate in jobs. But if they're doing exactly the same job with no difference in responsibility, then they should be paid the same thing as the permanent employee. So that's Senate Bill 610. At this point, would the chair prefer to hear from Bowley about 610, and then I'll move back to 611, or shall I continue on through 611?
why don't we go with Ms. Newhall, and you can testify if you would like on all the bills that you want to testify on, if that's your preference.
Okay.
Or you can come back, whichever you'd prefer.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm the legislative director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 610, 611, and 624. And I guess if the chair is giving me my preference, I would prefer to follow the proponents of the measures just so that they can give their overview of what it is before my testimony. So on Senate Bill 610, we appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify. As you know, it would require day labor service agencies to be registered with the Bureau and outline standards under which these agencies would operate and provide for the day laborers that they employ. In addition to registering these agencies, the Bureau would be charged with monitoring compliance with the provisions regulating the day agencies. As you know, we are responsible for the enforcement of the laws covering state minimum wage, overtime requirements, working conditions, child labor, farm and forest labor, contracting, and wage collection. The Bureau does not currently regulate any day labor agencies other than under general wage and hour law. We understand the intent of this legislation is to provide better oversight of a largely underground labor market. And while we have not yet taken a formal position on this bill, we fully support the effort to provide greater oversight in this area. Under the provisions of Senate Bill 610, the day labor employers would be required to register with the Bureau for a fee of not exceeding $250. We would also be charged with monitoring the compliance of the provisions of 610, which, as Mr. Dale outlined, have various requirements for the day labor agencies, such as posting notice to the employees of the types of work being offered, including the employer names and addresses, the wages being paid, to post a notice provided by the Bureau to inform workers of a toll-free number for filing complaints about wage disputes and violations of day labor law, to also provide a written description of the job opportunity provided to day laborers, to provide at no cost to the day laborer any special attire, tools, safety equipment required, and also, as Mr. Dale said, to provide transportation back from the job site if the employer transports them to the job site. While the Bureau supports the intent of this legislation and the effort to better regulate and monitor this largely underground economy, we do have some questions about day labor agencies, primarily the prevalence of how many of them are in Oregon, how many would seek registration from the agency now or in the future. We are also unsure of what types of enforcement actions would be required to ensure compliance with this new law, or how many complaints would be filed with the agency as a result. We do assume that there would be an increase in the number of investigations conducted by our agency, and that there would be a subsequent increase in civil penalties and license-related actions initiated by the agency and our hearings unit. Despite these uncertainties, however, we are very supportive of the general effort to better regulate this practice that we know can hurt vulnerable and low-income immigrant workers. We are also happy to work with the advocates to get a better understanding of the prevalence of these practices and day labor agencies in general, and what enforcement efforts might be necessary to ensure compliance with this law.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for the panel?
Senator George. When you were discussing the bill, and as I read the bill, I'm having a difficult time understanding exactly who you're, when you said employer. So a business hires employment agency to contract for labor. It looks like this bill is establishing a employer-employee relationship with the original contractor to the employees of the contract agency firm. Is that what this bill does? Because that's what it looks like it does.
Under certain circumstances, Senator George, I'm apologizing. Under certain circumstances, it does do that. There may be an employment relationship under existing law, but it clarifies when an employment relationship occurs, and that is when the actual control over the work terms or regular employment in the business of the subject employer, putative employer, I'll say, when that occurs, then it recognizes that is an employment relationship. It may well be an employment relationship under existing law. Now, if you hire a day laborer to trim some trees in your yard, that's not going to create that kind of employment relationship. So it doesn't, in every case, do that.
Okay, so when I read the bill, it looks like it established an employer-employee relationship with somebody else, another company's employees, and that makes me very, very nervous. So the second question is, at the end of your testimony, you described a scenario where I hire a temp agency to bring somebody in to work in my office who does basically something else that somebody else in my office does, and that they should be paid the same. But as an employer of my employee who's doing a certain activity, and I have a surge in business, and so I need to bring in a temp agency, I can't really govern what that person makes. And in fact, there's all kinds of additional costs. So, like, for instance, I already have all my human resources covered in my overheads, and I have these, so I may have a higher salary, where a temp agency has an increased cost basis. So I may pay $14 an hour to this employee. I pay a temp agency maybe $16, but actually $11 gets to the actual their employee. So, A, how am I ever supposed to make sure that my employee gets paid the same as their employee? It seems like a paperwork nightmare because you have all kinds of different people come in. And then second of all, why would that be functional? Because you have different economies of scale. I have my employees covered by my human resources department. They have a totally different set of expenses. So why would you ever equate those two things? Because the employment relationship is really important here. So those two things really have me concerned about the bill.
Chair Shields, Senator George, I seem to want to think I'm in the House of Representatives, for which I greatly apologize.
The same questions.
We are quite willing to work on figuring out the details of that so it's an appropriate level. The idea is to avoid the situation where, because of differences in pay rate, what you have is the phenomenon that's known in the industry is perma-temps, people that are temporary employees in name only, work for 6 months, then they have to be off for a while, and then they work again. And the point is, if they're doing the regular work of the industry that they're employed in, they ought not to be kept in temporary status merely because it's cheaper to do so than to pay regular employees. That's the point of the bill. Crafting the language to do that, we are really open on figuring out how to do that in a way that's fair and equitable both to the employer and the employee.
Senator Boquist.
Two questions, Mr. Chair, if you would, please. I think the first question is you've already stated, and I just want to make sure that I clearly understand, and that is that 610 as written doesn't get there even in your mind at this point. It needs some work on it yet.
Yes, that's quite correct, Senator Boquist.
And follow-up question, Mr. Chair, if you would, please. I guess I see the temp agency. I see day labor here, and I guess what I'm struggling with is I work under the federal code, so I probably have a broader perspective of how bad regulation or good regulation can be in retrospect to some other colleagues. So, and a lot of this is covered with federal law, but even in federal law, in the environment that I work with, and it doesn't work. And here's the prime example, and this is, I thought, where the bill was kind of really trying to go here. And I won't lose the locations, that way the federal government will sue me. There are multiple locations that we work at, and there are industries that provide services to the government in that area, and they come to the front of, we'll just say, that building or installation, and they need 7 or 8 extra workers. And so they literally get a day worker right off the front. I'm trying to be generic enough here that I don't get myself in trouble. Right out of the front, and of course, they keep them for a day, and then they, at the end of the day, you know, they release them, and some of them they pick because they know who they are. They come back occasionally. They might work 4 or 5 days, 2 or 3 weeks. But the problem does exist because I pay the price from both security and regulatory precision or pressure. In the day laborer went out, picked 5 guys up, came back. He promised them $100 a day. He pays them 50, and of course, they don't have any recourse. It is really the underground economy. And more so, it might not be a well-documented individual. And so they know that they paid a guy, they promised him 100, they paid him 50, and they stiffed him, and he put in a good day's work, but they know the guy's not going to come back, especially since this is on a federal institution or a federal contract, is not going to make a complaint. And I think part of this bill is that's what you're trying to address, that portion of the underground economy. Or is it all the businesses that have shops out and the temp agencies?
Senator Boquist, you're quite right that the informal underground economy is a lot of what this bill is focused on. And I'd point out that the problem with documentation isn't necessarily exactly the one that you're alluding to. They may have promised these workers $10 an hour, but how in the world are they going to prove it? It was some guy named George in a green van, and there were some other guys that went with them whom they don't know, and there's nothing written. And that's part of what we're trying to get at here.
Sure.
Yes, what was Mr. George's first name?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have a green van. No green van.
Larry, you were just over at my house. What do you mean?
Well, I seem determined to step in it today.
Well, there must be familiar questions in the House, but I see a separation between the two. I know there's an underground economy, and I use the example of my own business and outside of the state of Oregon, but I know contractors that face the same problem, which they cannot compete because they're getting day laborers literally off the street, maybe just right outside of the job site. And this happens. But then the flip side is, how do you, I guess when you go to crafting this thing, the concern I would have is how do you have legitimate businesses that are doing it right that we're not going to drive into the ground who are barely surviving already? So they're already doing it right. And how do we capture the underground? Because we want to capture the underground, all of us do here, because the underground portion of it pays taxes. If we get to pay taxes, we won't be the budget crunch we are. So just my 2 cents, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah. Chairman Shields, Senator Boquist, you're quite right that we want to make it so that actually it's an advantage to the legitimate companies because they don't have to compete with people that are cutting corners and not paying their workers.
Thank you.
And my question is, I mean, just as a matter of practice, I think there are a number of, for example, manufacturing firms that might hire through an employment service, keep the person on the on their temporary payroll for 2 years, 3 years. Is there, you mentioned 6 months, is there something in statute that requires that they can only keep somebody at that level for 6 months and then there has to be a shift?
Chair Shields, that is not, to my knowledge, a regulatory thing. It is more a practice. There could be in certain circumstances, for example, that in the tech industry up in Washington, there was a lawsuit about who belonged into the pension program and who didn't, and if people were truly permanent employees, they, and I'm not familiar with all the details of that litigation, but essentially it held that some of these folks were permanent employees that were entitled to some benefits that permanent employees got and weren't being paid, and so I think that may be part of the reasons why, is just to break it up to make it clearer that they are temporary. But for family wage earners who are trying to support children and send them to school and properly provide for them, that kind of an employment relationship is really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely require some businesses to change the way they do business. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing. You know, particularly those who are not taking responsibility for their employees, instead keeping them on the temporary payroll for 2, 3, 4 years.
Shall I move on to
yes,
Senate Bill
611?
Senate Bill 611 is kind of a house cleaning kind of question under Oregon statutes. Under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, there's a definition of employment that's broad, of who is an employer that's broad. Oregon uses that same definition for its minimum wage law. But for other provisions of wage law, they use a different definition that's narrower. And it's confused the courts. The Court of Appeals has wrestled with this in at least four cases and has not really been able to come up with a clear formulation. And what we're trying to do in this bill is standardize throughout wage law, not into unemployment and workers' comp and some other areas like that. We're not talking about that, but just for purposes of the areas that are specified in the bill, which is basically the Farm Labor Contractor Registration Act, the CCB statute, the Construction Contractors Board statute, the 652, the General Wage Claim Collection statute, and 653, the Minimum Wage statute, to have the definition the same, and the same as the federal definition, so we don't have these differing interpretations. Everybody knows who's covered and who's not, and it all becomes clearer. We didn't quite get there with this bill either. There's a question that we've discussed with Boley that I think Ms. Newhall will probably address, and that is that the way the bill is drafted, it doesn't necessarily accomplish that with respect to Boley's wage collection statute, and so we need to work on a fix with that. And I don't have draft language. I think it would be fairly easy to do, but that's basically Senate Bill 611.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, Legislative Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Let's see, I'm going to skip a lot of my testimony here because I'll submit it to you in writing. I didn't get handed over as I came. But I think we, in terms of standardizing the terms of employer and employee, we definitely appreciate efforts to create consistency among the statutes and with the Fair Labor Standards Act. Generally, we believe that standardized definitions make enforcement for compliance, both enforcement and compliance, easier for employers and employees alike. We do, however, want to flag that standardizing some of these terms in law, while standardizing some of these terms in law makes sense, some of the proposed amendments may have some unintended impacts. For example, redefining employer to include a person acting directly or indirectly in the interest of an employer in relation to an employee appears to include not only individual business owners, but also supervisors and managers acting on behalf of the employer. This change would vastly increase the number of individuals who would be liable for unpaid wages, penalty wages, and civil penalties. Additionally, because the definition of an employee is basically to suffer or permit to work, defining employee to mean an individual employed by an employer may substantially expand the definition of employee. To the point that Mr. Dale was raising earlier, it is an issue that we have been in discussion with, and I think he is correct in that it's a fairly simple amendment to correct. But just to explain it a little bit further, it would result, the changing these definitions in 653, 658, and 701 leaves the existing definitions of employer and employee in Chapter 652, which are the Bureau's wage collection laws, and it would put us, by not changing those definitions accordingly, it would put us in a slightly awkward position of enforcing the current definitions in 652 that would then the definitions in 653 and 658 would be slightly broader than what we would have authority to do wage collection cases on. So I guess our point on that would be, if we're going to change the definitions, we would advocate for consistency through all of those statutes so that our wage collection enforcement provisions matched up with other definitions of employer and employee.
Thank you.
And if I may, Chair Shields, that was the intent of the bill, and there's a quirk in the drafting that causes that problem, and I think we can fix it.
And so do you want to also comment on the next one? Or have you
if I could say one more thing about 611, on the question of the definition of employer includes a person who acts as the agent of the employer in dealing with employees. I agree with the analysis that that broadens who's subject to be an employer under state law. I don't agree, I think, that it would vastly increase the numbers of people liable. And the reason for that is that standard isn't something that I made out of my head. That's something that is in federal law now. So anyone who engages in interstate commerce already is subject to that liability. Already is subject to that liability. And we're just trying to standardize it so that it's the same rule for everybody.
Senator Boquist.
Just a point of clarification. You said some are narrow, some are wider. But the goal is to standardize to the federal standard. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Good. All right. Are we done?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Newhall.
Can I ask a question,
Senator Bonamici?
Mr. Chair, are there amendments being drafted? You had the other one. You had your notes on it, so we could sort of follow along. Do you have something showing what you're planning to change in this one as well?
Senator Bonamici, we do not have that yet because those are issues that have come up in the last couple days, but we will get them to the committee quickly.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much for your testimony. You're done with all three, right?
We didn't do 624.
624. Okay.
Still.
Let's jump in.
Senate Bill, I suppose I should identify myself if we're going to split the record up somewhere. No, don't need to. Okay. Senate Bill 624 addresses a big problem that we have in collecting wages on behalf of low-wage workers. I think probably on behalf of any workers, but my experience is with low-wage workers. We'll often go to court, establish liability, establish the amount of liability, spend a lot of time in the employee's time as well in getting a judgment, and then we have a judgment that we can't collect. In the 6+ years that the Northwest Worker Justice Project has existed, we've accumulated judgments on behalf of 57 workers who are owed $505,930 plus interest.
Could we ask the witness to back off from the mic about 6 inches or more? It's coming across really garbled. These are very sensitive mics. They'll pick you up a foot, 2 feet away.
Thank
when you get real close to them, it's kind of garbly.
I've been told that before, too, and I forgot. Thank you. What I was saying is that in the 6+ years that the Northwest Worker Justice Project has existed, we've collected, or we've won judgments for about $500,000 in wages that we can't collect the judgment and may never collect the judgment. And
to give you a frame of reference, in the same period of time, we've collected about $1.2 million. So proportionally, you can see it's a big problem. Other lawyers tell me the same. I believe the same problem exists at Boley. We need additional tools to be able to collect these wages once that you establish that they're due. The way we go about doing that is allow workers to assert a lien for their wages. Now, some workers already have that right, mechanics, people in the construction industry, people in agriculture, but it's kind of an unfair right that they have in some sense, because the lien is not against the employer who's not paying them properly. The lien is against somebody else who may have already paid the employer and winds up having to pay twice. And that makes it difficult to persuade courts to follow, and doesn't leave us with a good sense of justice having been done, all things considered, as advocates in the system. What this lien would do that's different, it's based on a law in Wisconsin that seems to be working well. In Wisconsin,
Wisconsin remarks. Go ahead.
I had no idea how timely this proposal would really be. Has nothing to do with collective bargaining for public employees, I would add. This law creates allows workers to assert a lien not against someone else, but against the employer, against the personal or real property of the employer. And then they have to file within 120 days a lawsuit to be able to show that they're actually entitled to recover. But the notion would be that this would allow us to get into the situation before everything gets transferred out of the corporation or everything gets hidden under the mattress or whatever, and actually be able to collect some of these. And it's a fairly simple idea. No doubt it would be controversial to some folks, particularly because we say it's a super lien, that it's a lien that goes to the top of the list. Now, I've been contacted by the Department of Revenue, who was going to send over some language. I didn't receive the language. We don't want to assert that it goes ahead of tax liens. There is a limit with respect to commercial enterprises, commercial lending enterprises, of $3,000. It would be the maximum a worker could assert under this lien, as a prior lien to a lien that a bank had or so forth. That's Senate Bill 624.
That's great. Thanks. Ms. Newhall, anything?
All right. Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 624, which, as Mr. Dale explained, does two things: essentially reiterate and clarify the existing right of employees to file private action to resolve wage claimers disputes, and authorizes liens on employers' property for unpaid wages. A lot of the work that we do as an enforcement agency revolves around resolving wage claims disputes and investigating wage claims made by employees. We process about 2,600 wage claims each year filed by workers alleging that wages are due to them. When an employee files a wage claim with us, when an employee claims wages, they have two options to resolve the dispute. They can either file a wage claim with the Bureau, or they can pursue the matter privately by suing the employer for the unpaid wages. The Bureau fully supports the right of employees to choose how best for themselves to resolve wage claims, to do it either privately or by filing a wage claim with the Bureau. Employees might opt to file private action if they are seeking penalty wages in addition to the wages that they claim, since the Bureau, as a general policy, doesn't seek penalty wages in addition to the wages that are being claimed. Conversely, an employee may not have the resources necessary to hire an attorney or to take private action, and may, as a resource issue, decide to file a wage claim with the Bureau and resolve the issue through the administrative law process. As such, we support the amendments to OR 652 to solidify this right of employees. The provisions of 624 also establish lien authority for wages owed to employees by providing that an employee who brings an action under 652 has a lien on all the property, real and personal, located in this state for the amount of the unpaid wages to which the employee is entitled. We would suggest one clarifying amendment. If these are liens that would be assigned to Boley, we would suggest that that this language be clarified to provide that the lien is on the employer's property and not all properties located in the state. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. I think we needed to understand fully what your perspective of what the bills did before we moved on. So, colleagues, we'll go ahead and we'll bring up some of the opponents to this bill. Jan Meekums and J.L.
Thank you, Senator Jones.
Thank you. And JL, are you testifying on all three or just two?
My comments are going to be on two, Mr. Okay. Chair.
And so feel free to continue on if you'd prefer.
Thank
back
you.
To back.
I'll go ahead. Thank you, Chair Shields and members. For the record, JL Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industry. My comments are going to be on Senate Bills 611 and 624, and I'm going to just talk about the bills at face value because I didn't know the impetus going in. The concept of wage theft was new to me at 1 o'clock today, and I don't say that. I'm not trying to be glib. I just implicit in these bills is somehow the understanding that the Boley process is not working, or the process to sue an employer in civil court for a wage claim is not working, or that the wage replacement fund is not adequate, or we're going to help Boley this session deal with insufficient fund checks to employees. So there seem to be a lot of avenues for recovery of wages. So I'm not sure the impetus for these bills, what about current recovery methods are not adequate. But taking a look at 611, we oppose this because the language that redefined an employer to any other person acting directly or indirectly in the interest of an employer in relation to an employee, I couldn't really begin to tell you what that covers. I know it's supposed to be modeled loosely on the federal, the FLSA, which has a definition of exercising control over the nature and structure of the employment relationship. But as you would expect, we send out this definition in 611 to a half dozen attorneys, and we got a half dozen answers. And, anything could be folded into the Senate Bill 611 definition. Got back HR professionals, payroll managers, payroll service, outside consultants, outside counsel, or any other potential supervisory employee. The bottom line with 611 for us is we think it makes employers out of a lot of Oregonians who wouldn't be considered employers in any other context except for wage claims. And that is the reason that we oppose 611 in its current form. 624, I understood the testimony for recovery of wages in the event that you couldn't recover from an employer after a lawsuit. The problem is 624 allows you to file a lien without any evidentiary findings whatsoever. As you heard in the bill, you can file a lien against an employer by alleging unpaid wages. So you file the wage claim, not in Boley because you don't have to under this bill, but you file it in court and in conjunction with that pay the fee, and all of a sudden you have a lien on an employer's assets. It's probably easier to talk about what's not in the bill, which is basically any controls whatsoever. No judicial findings, no evidentiary showings, no determination of the validity of the claim, no exhaustion of administrative remedies. You don't even have to file with Boley. No recourse for the employer and no process for an employer to challenge or clear the lien. So it opens up a can of worms. And I'll take it one step further because obviously this is how attorneys think, and this was conveyed to me pretty clearly. There are a lot of law firms that do wage claims. That is what they do. There will be law firms that do liens and will be lien factories. And the potential for abuse under this bill is limitless. And, we also suspect that it may be a weapon used in corporate organizing campaigns. So this is an issue that has far broader ramifications in our mind than just the issue of trying to collect, wages that are not due. And again, my question is, what about current processes aren't working that would necessitate something like Senate Bill 624? And I think you would see our concern there.
Ms. Meekums.
Thank you.
Committee.
Chair Shields and the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. I'm also here representing Oregon Small Business Coalition as well. And I reiterate what JL has said from AOI. This is speaking first on Senate Bill 624, I agree, what isn't working? We have BOLI, who does 2,600 claims per year. In 6 years, they've done about 15,600 wage claims. We have, on the other hand, he was talking about 57 people in 6 years that they have not been able to satisfy their claims. So we're talking about a far-reaching piece of legislation that covers 57 people in a period of 6 years. We consider that this is particularly onerous and egregious bill concerning small business in Oregon. The lien provision can actually stop a small business if they're in the middle of some sort of a transaction, whether it's real estate or personal, on a piece of property for the purpose of conducting their life or their business, and by paying a fee and filling out a claim, it can stop that process. The procedure presented is one of presumed guilty until proven innocent. It appears this can be accomplished so easily that it would be open the door for many aggravated, frivolous situations that would hurt small business at a time when they're already struggling. And that's all I have to say regarding 624. Regarding Senate Bill 611, relating to standardized definition of employee, employer, and wages, agreed with what JL has to say. This is a proverbial Pandora's box with untold possibilities in the realm of unintended consequences for all employers, including small businesses in Oregon that make up 97% of all employers in the state. So NFIB, an Oregon Small Business Coalition, opposes Senate Bill 611. And I would like to speak on Senate Bill 610 as well. Small businesses are in a position, many of them, that cannot take on full-time employees. And so they depend on agencies to fill the gaps. And this is a question, again, where a large percentage of the businesses are providing a good service. They're abiding by laws. They're abiding by regulation. And I think we're taking a situation of the few and regulating the many. And it's just a situation of a bill that would be challenging to decipher and implement. It's over-regulation, it's additional fees and expenses, and it opens additional liability and exposure to small businesses. So NFIB, OSBC is in opposition to all three of these bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. And just for the record, could you tell us who the Oregon Small Business Coalition is?
Oregon Small Business Coalition is an association of several small business associations, such as the Restaurant Association and NFIB. So it's an association of small business coalition.
Could you tell us who the members are?
Yeah, I'll get you the exact list. I'll send that to the committee.
Okay. JL, do you know who the members are of that coalition?
Oh, as a form, excuse me, Chair Shield, as a member of the Small Business Coalition formerly, it was exactly who you would expect to lobby business issues, the restaurants, the Farm Bureau, nurseries, builders and contractors. Those are what come to mind.
Any others that you can think of?
No, I've been removed from the OSBC for a number of years now that I represent big business.
the Bankers Association, are they members of the?
Yes.
Small Business Coalition?
Yes.
Okay. All right, good. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Any other questions? Good. All right, so we've got quite a few people signed up. We're going to start with the people who have come the greatest distance, 100 miles or more. So could we please have Tyler Brown come forward, please, followed by, should we go back over here? Yeah. Why don't we bring up two people, Tyler Brown and Trisha Stackhouse, Kelly Services. And and then we'll bring up a panel of the proponents. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you identify yourself and please begin?
Sure. Want to go first?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tricia Stackhouse. I'm the territory manager for Kelly Services that covers Northwest Portland, and I also have with me in the audience Tiffany Young, who covers our operations in the Willamette Valley in Southern Oregon. Kelly Services employs more than 50 full-time employees in the state of Oregon and over 2,000 temporary employees on average every day here in the state of Oregon. This bill, Senate Bill 610, would impact our business and the thousands of employees who have found full-time employment through our services or who have been able to pursue flexible work options through working for a staffing agency. This bill would also have a negative impact on the thousands of clients that rely on our services to recruit and place the talent that they need to operate their businesses every day. And that would have a very negative impact, I think, on business here in Oregon. Staffing firms play a critical role in the labor market, and there really doesn't seem to be a need for such regulation on our industry, as I feel we've been a very good partner here in the state. Thank you.
Very concise. Much appreciated.
I'll try to do the same. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tyler Brown, and I'm with K-Force. We're a professional staffing firm in the state of Oregon. I represent my colleagues who are here today, as well as our office in the Portland market. We have about 20 core employees that work for the firm, and currently we employ, with our clients, approximately 150 people. We feel a lot of the same sentiments that over the course of the last 3 years during the downturn in the economy, when jobs is our number one priority. We've made 300 placements with our clients in that time period. We're not the largest in the market, but we're a big player. And what we've done is not only provide a service to our clients in filling jobs that they had open, but we actually brought candidates to those same clients and created a job. And we're not the only ones to do that. So we feel we provide a very professional service. Anybody who works for a firm like K-Force is an employee of our firm. We offer them full suite of benefits, a 401k package, and many of the provisions in Bill 610 would negatively affect our business in a major way, and we oppose it for that reason. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Questions? Great. Let's bring up the next panel. Thanks. Ramon Ramirez, Romeo Sosa, John Mullis, and Meg Niemi. Was that your preference to have all four? Same time? Okay.
Right there.
I think we lost John Mullis, but.
All right. We might need an additional chair if we could. So, welcome to the committee. We do have a lot of people, so anything, if you could try to keep your testimony to 3 minutes, then make sure that everybody has a chance to have their voice heard.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN. Our English name is Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United. And I'm here to strongly encourage you to support the passage of Senate Bill 624 and Senate Bill 611. Farm workers are Oregon's most valuable workers. We're the ones who toil the fields, do hard work to put food on the American table. And yet the only thing that we get from our hard labor is a wage. So wages become very important to us. And what we have found over the last several years is an increase in violations of minimum wage law in agriculture, primarily in the pre-straight crops, and also an increase in wage fraud. A survey that I included in my testimony for the record that we completed in 2009 of over 200 farm workers working in the berry harvest and paid by piece rate, we found that there was violations of Oregon minimum wage law. What we found was three significant things. One is that 90% of those that we interviewed were consistently paid below minimum wage. On an average day, the underpayment was about $25, and the hourly wage was about $5.35 an hour, 36% below what the minimum wage was for that year of $8.40. What we did when we found out that we found this, what was going on, is rather than have a press conference and denounce these kinds of violations, we actually did the opposite. We first went to some leaders of the agricultural community and presented the findings of our study, because we felt like we really needed a solution to this problem, and we did that. And in addition to that, we met with leaders of Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we came up with a plan that we're continually working on as I speak today. And that is, the first thing we did was they contacted a number of piece rate growers and had a community meeting, a large community meeting in Woodburn, to explain the minimum wage laws. And I thought I was present there, and I thought I was really successful. In addition to that, there was a farm worker briefing in Woodburn where a number of farm workers came and were educated around the minimum wage laws. Because we felt like that when you have that kind of violations of minimum wage laws, that, you know, it's important to get as many players involved. So, you know, we think that that Senate Bill 611 and 624 is a step in the right direction. We think that what we found in this particular case of these minimum wage violations is that we had a hard time pinpointing who the employer was. The majority of work that's being done in piece rate crops in Willamette Valley is done by farm labor contractors. Many are licensed and also, you know, regulated, and there are some that are not. And that's where we see a majority of problems. So we think that these two bills will address those issues, and we want to advocate for their passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Dear Senate and Committee, my name is Romeo Sosa, and I work for VOS, Worker Rights Education Project, and our main constituency are day laborers, and I'm going to speak about, like, how they work. Most of the laborers, they are, like, 90% are Latinos, come from Central South America, and the 10% are U.S. Americans, Asian, African American, and some women that look for work. We have three locations in Portland, like two street corners and a worker center. Most of them, they're doing like moving the most hard work in the city. And some of them, they have painting houses, working in the garden, cleaning houses, or taking care of the babies. There are about 200 and 300 day laborers on a daily basis looking for work. Also, I just want to talk a little bit about the life of the day laborers that are in uncertainty. They don't know, like, who's going to employ them, what kind of work they're going to do, and they don't know if they're going to get paid that day, and they don't know if they're going to get water or breaks, and it's a life of uncertainty. And some of them, like, they don't know if they're going to provide medical treatment if they're going to get injured in the work. I just want to mention that the wage theft, it's a serious problem, and it requires attention from everyone. Wage theft is sometimes not really talked about, but we, as a worker, as a face every day, like, all the abuses happen with day laborers. I feel like needs something to be done big than like we're trying to do. Only since VOS, we started the VOS, and 10 years ago, we collect about 300,000 of wages, like an employer that don't want to pay. Only last year, we have 39 cases, and it's about $37,000 employee didn't refuse to pay. Some of the cases, they are like, they offer like the $10, like somebody mentioned, and they pay at the end $5 an hour. Or some of them, they give like a check without funding. Or some of them, they just don't pay at all, which is the most common thing that happen. And seems like it's becoming like, okay, it's that okay to not pay a worker. For us, as me as a person, I can feel like that when somebody come to me and says, I didn't get paid for the work. I work 3 hours, 6 hours, even months. And it's a serious problem. And I just want to tell, like, there's so many stories since, like, as a human, I can feel also, like I mentioned, like these people, they are suffering. I'm just going to tell like two stories. One is about this employer comes every time in many different days and hire day laborers two or three and don't pay them. And then turn back again. And it end up, this case is about 16 people. They didn't get paid and he owes about $18,000 for the total of the workers. But at the end of that, some of them, they told me, he asked us to work like 24 hours a day, and since they have that need, so they have to work the 24 hours, and sometimes they just get like 2 hours sleep and then back to work day. And at the end, he didn't pay them. It's still the case, still continue. And another case, I just want to bring it up, is that he worked in Oregon City. And he hired a day laborer, he took it to Oregon City, paint the house inside and outside, and at the end of that, he disappeared, and he left. And but the guy who hired him, the owner of the house, he already paid the guy who hired him. So when this employer asked for his money, he says, I already paid whatever your boss is. Yeah. So, and at the end, this guy didn't have any information and didn't have, like, the money to get back. He has to walk, like, 3 hours to get back to wherever he picked up. And among of these...
Mr. Sosa, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm afraid I'm going to have to move on so that we can make sure that other people have a chance to tell their stories. But I really appreciate you bringing those stories forward to us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, my name is Meg Neamey, and I'm the president of SEIU Local 49, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bills 610 and 611. Our local union represents over 3,000 janitors who work in commercial office buildings, government buildings, and schools. We represent in total over 8,000 workers, including hospital and clinic workers like certified nurses aides, LPNs, phlebotomists, in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And as the largest and fastest growing union in the United States of property services workers, as we call janitors and security officers, we hear from a lot of workers who have faced wage theft. And we acknowledge, and I heard the testimony earlier today about the work that BOLI is doing, and we really applaud the work of Commissioner Avakian and his staff on pursuing those issues, but we feel like there are some other concerns that need to be addressed through these bills. And in addressing these problems, we think the following principles are important to consider. That wage law enforcement will ensure that there's a level playing field for honest employers, that proper enforcement of wage laws ensures that our community standards for wages and working conditions remain intact, and that given our current budget crisis, enforcing wage and hour laws should help make certain that all Oregonians are paying their fair share in taxes. And we believe that by establishing clear policies for violations of wage and hour law, proper qualifications and certifications for contractors, and consistency in the definitions of the terms in Senate Bills 610 and 11, we would meet those principles. And a story I'll share was chronicled in the Willamette Weekly under their Rogue of the Week that was awarded to National Maintenance Contractors, or NMC, and there were three brothers who purchased a franchise from NMC in and were awarded the contract for cleaning the Park Plaza West building in Beaverton. And they were told by NMC that they purchased it for about $8,000. They were told they would be making about $3,350 per month from that contract. And instead, when they were paid, it was $541.50 that they received after money was deducted for administrative fees and supplies. Their time combined added up to 195 combined hours of work. And so if you pencil that out, you're talking about $2.78 per hour before taxes. So, and as franchisees and not employees, they're not guaranteed work or entitled to any benefits. In fact, they're not even allowed to talk to their clients, the folks that they're cleaning the building. And recent national studies have shown that 26% of low-wage workers were paid less than the minimum wage in the week prior to that survey. 76% of those who worked more than 40 hours were not paid the legally required overtime rate. And I think you've heard testimony as well that supports that from Pocoon. And we recognize that there are still some technical details to be worked out in this bill, but we believe that for employers who are operating in an honest fashion and already paying wages as they are supposed to, this will not have any impact on them. And what we're really looking to do is to make sure that those honest employers, as Senator Boquist was speaking of, are actually operating in an equal playing field for everyone. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. There's also someone here from the Department of Revenue, but I think because we have so many people that are just everyday citizens that want to testify on this, that the Department of Revenue person, we might ask you to come back if we decide to move forward with this bill down the road. So if you want to get back to work, feel free. That's to John Phillips. All right, let's bring up...
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Yes. Let's bring up Sue Jack, Ron Holtz, and Alex Mady.
I'd like to defer to my colleague.
Okay. Feel free. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you could just identify yourself and
absolutely
start going.
Chair Shields and committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 610. I represent Volt Workforce Solutions.
I'm sorry, did you identify yourself by name?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Sue Jack.
Okay.
And I represent Volt Workforce Solutions. It is a staffing company. We have two offices in the Portland metro area. And I'm the regional vice president responsible for all of the business in the Oregon Territory. I have in-house staff of about 50 people, of which 15 are corporate marketing, and the rest are recruiters, salespeople, and support staff. On a daily basis, we employ anywhere between 1,000 to 1,500 people out at our client sites. And over the course of the year, we will employ up to 5,000 people just in Oregon. What our role is within our partnerships with our clients, and I am going to mention some of our clients because ultimately this affects the end user. And our clients include companies such as Intel, HP, Bonneville Power, and the State of Oregon. So this will ultimately affect you. What we do is we screen, hire, interview, and actually also train and mentor our employees. A lot of our employees are just not with Volt for a temporary assignment. They are employees of Volt. And, in fact, one of our employees has been with Volt here in Oregon for over 30 years. We offer full-time benefits for all of our employees, including manufacturing distribution. I do want to make a clarifying point. We do not do day labor. The end result of this particular bill will impact our business significantly. The end result will be, with the wage equality, will be for us to have to pay our current employees an equal wage plus a 30% surcharge, along with our costs on top of that. Obviously, those costs will be passed on to the end user, our clients, including the State of Oregon. With that being said, it's going to really eventually cost all of our companies that we do business with more money to staff their organizations. We will be eliminating the need for a flexible workforce, and they're going to have to hire people directly because of the costs associated with this additional 30% surcharge. So I would like to let you know we're very concerned that this will put staffing companies out of business in the state of Oregon and will absolutely affect the economic recovery in the state of Oregon. So Volt opposes Senate Bill 610. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jack. In fact, my first job when I moved to Portland was with Volt.
Oh, there you go.
Temping. One of those high-level temp jobs that I had.
Before I
got demoted to being a legislator. Pay and benefits were better. Welcome to the committee.
Dear Chairman Shields and the members of the committee, my name is Paul Shevchenko. I am the district manager for Labor Ready. We're one of the largest temporary laborers in the country. We, in 2010, put out 300,000 workers here in the state of Oregon. I have 14 locations, and we put 6,000 workers out to work. I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 610, and this would definitely put a major hurt on our business. I want to also clear something up. We're definitely, our business model is on demand, or call it day labor. But to Senator Boquist, you were talking about the underground work that's going on. I want to clear that up. We oppose that. We follow all the regulatory laws, the state laws, the workers' compensation. When a worker gets hurt, we put them on modified light duty. What this would do, we would put those 6,000 more workers back on the street, literally, and they would go back into the underground work. Our workers literally come from colleges, universities, people are in between jobs, and we do pay fairly. To a mom-and-pop business agent or temporary business that might have seasonality spikes or fluctuation in their business, this is a win-win for them. I'll give you a testimony. For example, when the fire seasons go out of control in Southern Oregon like we had a couple years ago, we will immediately staff, and these people have gone through E-Verify. We go through the proper I-9 identification, and we're able to partner up with companies to provide that type of service. I often say 9 out of 10 businesses around just here in Salem are using a staffing company. So with the diversified or the hard economy that we're seeing right now, this just gives more companies that flexibility for using companies such as Labor Ready.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions?
Chair.
Yes, Senator George.
I just want to comment. My experience is that in the day labor situation where you have the abuses is when you have somebody who doesn't have a legitimate business, like maybe somebody who wants somebody to clean their yard or paint their house on the cheap. It's not typically businesses who are hiring the dodgy day labor firms. In fact, most legitimate businesses hire companies like Labor Ready, which go through legitimate systems. And so one of the frustrating things is I don't think even if you pass this legislation, you would do huge damage to these folks who are great assets to the business community, but you probably still wouldn't fix the problem. And I think that's kind of what you were saying in general. You guys are a huge asset. We appreciate what you do in the economy. At the same time, I'm not sure you even address the problem if you pass these pieces of legislation. So,
by the way, I don't think I got my last paycheck 14 years ago.
You go. You can call the next one. Okay. Go ahead and call the next one, and I'll make a comment.
Alex Mady. Gone through. Okay, thank you. Roger Cummings, Dwayne Grange, and Pamela Akey.
Mr. Chair, I kind of share some of the concerns Senator George has, because the gentleman in the green shirt here that testified, that's the crux of the problem. And in Oregon law, the way it is right now, as example, any one of these shady companies that puts their shingle up and says, I'm Acme Employment, right, and doesn't register with the state of Oregon, the state of Oregon does absolutely nothing to that company. They can go out there and operate, and the Secretary of State will tell us, legitimate business people, honest to God, this is what they'll say, is, oh, you can take them to court. And so that's the companies we need to go after to make a level playing field, and the ones like the gentleman in the green shirt here, and I apologize for calling him, that are doing these shady deals. That's the issue right there.
Thank you for your comment. Welcome to the committee.
Choose
who you would like to go first.
Thank you for letting us testify today. My name is Pamela Ake, and I'm president of a very small staffing firm called Accounting Connections. And no one ever calls me and says, hey, will you send me 30 staff accountants tomorrow morning? Ours is mostly onesie-twosie. But part of that, I would like to oppose Senate Bill 610, and the piece that I want to talk about is the blanket prohibition of fees for services. And there is in Section 8.3 that provides employment agencies would not be allowed to restrict the right of an applicant to accept permanent employment with a third-party employer to whom the applicant has been referred for temporary work, or restrict the right of the third-party employer to offer permanent employment to the applicant, nor would it be permitted to charge the applicant an applicant fee or fine for accepting an offer of permanent employment from a third-party employer, or charge a third-party employer additional amounts for offering permanent employment to the applicant. This reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the staffing firms in today's market. Staffing firms do not restrict their employees from accepting permanent employment, and actually, permanent is probably not a good word, because honestly, we're all temps.
Yeah.
We're all temps. Accepting, you know, long-term employment with their clients or the businesses, and restricts the businesses from making job offers. Nor do they have any economic incentive to do so. Much of the staffing businesses today are so-called temp-to-hire arrangements, which in my case is probably 80 to 85% of our business. And we do, for those businesses, we do all of the recruiting, the screening, we place them, we do drug testing. In my business, we do background checks, criminal background checks, on each and every person that we put out to work. If staffing firms are barred from charging a fee to cover the cost of recruiting, screening, and training, and placing these people, there's no way any of us could stay in business. And so I would urge you to say no to 610.
Could I ask you a question about
sure.
that? And when a firm like yours sends an employee to go work at one of your clients, I mean, it is common practice to have some kind of buyout if the person wants to hire them in the
Correct.
First week or so.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some barriers. It's just how you phrase it, or how you the wording that you use to
in
describe
our,
it.
In my business, I work with the employer. We talk about all of this money before anyone is even sent out, so it's all clear. They know that there's a buyout, or we agree to a buyout of a price, or on some occasions there's, especially in this market, I'm waiving those buyout fees because we're all in this together. But I don't, I do not inhibit anyone from taking a position with a company.
Thank you. Who's next?
Okay. So my name is Roger Cummings, Chair Shields and committee members. I'm with ADECO Engineering and Technical, which is a part of the ADECO Group, which is a very large staffing organization. I'm here with three colleagues from the Engineering and Technical office in Portland, and then from the Wilsonville General Staffing Office. We have in Portland five offices, and there are additional companies that are under our umbrella, Agilon and Lee Hecht Harrison. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those firms or not, but we provide a variety of staffing services. And I think a lot of things have been said here today, but what I'd like to stress is the enormity of the importance of this industry on the economic engine of this state. I heard the state economist speak a couple of months ago, and temp hiring is one of the leading factors in economic recovery and an indicator of economic recovery. So I think we do play an important role in fostering the economy and getting out of this recession here. Our clients, they cut across just about every industry sector here in the state. And I think it's important that we touch pretty much every company and type of industry that there is here. What we do for those companies is that we provide a flexible labor pool, which enables them to be not only receptive to changes in the economy, but able to move their business forward in a way that will help them be successful and competitive. We work with a lot of firms that are just starting out, so we have a focus in some ways on some startup firms, and we provide very specialized talent as part of the engineering and technical division of ADECO. I guess some of the things that I could tell you are that for my branch, we employ about 300 people, and we have a monthly payroll of over $1 million, and that's average pay rate of $35 an hour, which wouldn't seem to be kind of in the normal sphere of what people would consider temp hiring. So it's a little bit different model, and there's a lot of different types of staff, and I just want to make sure that we understand the whole picture here. We're speaking against SB 610. We feel like it will negatively impact the business, and we would like to persuade you to that same way of thinking.
Thank you for your points of view.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for allowing myself. My name is Dwayne Grange. I represent Select Temp Employment Services and Flex Force Staffing Services. We have 6 locations in Oregon: Salem, Albany, Eugene, Roseburg, Medford, and Bend. We sent out over 4,000 W-2s for last year. And I'll keep my testimony short because I've submitted written testimony.
Thank you.
But I'd like to highlight, I'm here with our branch manager from the Salem branch. And I also have questions, as did Senator Boquist and Vice Chair Senator George had. Senator George had the question about equal pay. It would be very difficult for us to require our clients to pay equal pay, because some of our clients pay their regular employees based on their longevity. If we send somebody out there for a week's work and we have to pay them the same pay as they're paying their guy been there 20 years, you know, it's going to put us out of business. And two, we're very big on safety. In fact, we are members of the American Society of Safety Engineers. We are currently a graduate of the SHARP program. That's an OSHA program recognizing employers who exceed what OSHA requires. Also, we are a member of the SHARP Alliance. All this costs a lot of money to be a part of these organizations, and we support safety not only for our company, but our clients and any other company in the state of Oregon that calls us and asks us for assistance. We do not use safety as a competitive advantage over our competitors. We will assist them if they need help. And that costs. And also, Senator Boquist's concern or question was, would this bill affect legitimate established staffing services? And as it's written, it would, and it would adversely affect our company. In fact, it'd probably put us out of business. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your point of view. All right, we've got 4 more people, and then we are still hopeful to get to Senate Bill 655. Do we know how many people will be testifying on that? 4. Okay. Great. Now, if some of you are on this list and your coworkers have already presented, you know, feel free to take a pass if you're not interested in testifying. But if you want to, you know, that's why we're here. So please don't be shy. Let's bring up Paul Shevchenko, Alma Caceres, and James Brown.
Mr. Chair, question for you while they're coming up.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
I don't know what the law is, but I mean, Boley obviously had 2,600 complaints last year. I'm wondering if we can get some sort of report from them so we can identify where the problem area is. Obviously, there's a problem because there's bills, but to figure out what type of businesses are making these complaints, you know, where's the focus we should be drilling down on?
Okay. Bully, if you are out there, if you have those kinds of statistics, please file that request and get that back to the committee. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Committee, my name is James Brown. I'm with BDI Staffing. I am probably one of the smaller services represented here today. My office is here in Salem, and it's the only place where I have an office. I've been in business here in Salem for 24 years. Started the business, and we are still running along. At least the doors are still open after this recession. And I merely want to comment on the fact that I echo the concerns that my colleagues have already stated. And one of the major issues that I have with the bill is the intrusion of the government in determining what I have to pay my employees on any particular job as long as I am paying them the legally required salary of minimum wage, which I don't even think we have a minimum wage job right now. But when I send out a welder or a mechanic or a construction worker of any type, they know what the wage is. They have the right to accept it or decline it. We offer the job. We don't force them to take the work. And we're a legitimate business. We pay the taxes. And as Senator George mentioned, this will hurt legitimate businesses and really isn't going to solve the problem of catching the people that Senator Boquist referred to as the underground economy. I don't have a solution to the underground economy, but I would respectfully submit that passage of 610 would do severe harm to the staffing industry and would solve no problem of taking care of the underground economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your point of view. Any questions? All right. Is that all we have? All
right. I think so.
Dean Craig, did you want to testify? Or,
yeah, I think that was the last one.
Just me?
You just.
Thank you.
You're bad in cleanup. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to really just echo everything you've heard. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but as a business here in Oregon, founded here in Oregon, been here for 35 years. We would probably be out of business if this were to pass regarding 610 specifically. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your point of view. Senator Boquist, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, I just think Bully needs to start knuckling down and get us some information.
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate everybody who came down to testify. I think both sides had very good points, and we've got a lot to mull over as we try to figure out how we're going to try to get at the problem of the employers who aren't doing the right thing and what we might want to do about that. So we're not going to be taking this up for at least another couple of weeks again, and we'll be sure to give the posting notice that's required. And I really do want to thank all of you who came down to testify. This is your legislature, and we really appreciate your input into this process. I will. Does anybody else want to testify, by the way? Okay.
I'll be brief. My name is Tracy Facilli. I'm the president of Employment Trends. We have 16 offices throughout the Portland area. We've been in business for 20 years. We're also part of SOS Staffing, which is an international organization. I also am the sitting president for the Oregon Staffing Association. We are the local chapter of the American Staffing Association, and I believe you've received a paper from them representing some of our points.
Yeah.
I would just like to say that we have employed over 20,000 people a day. In 1 year, we bridged 35,000 people to full-time employment. In addition to that, in 1 year, we're over a $600 million industry. We are concerned about the mandates and the cost that this is going to cause to our industry, and we dramatically oppose 610. This will put members of the Staffing Association out of business. Branches will close, people will lose their jobs, and our sole function is to create jobs. So I would like to strongly oppose the bill as the Oregon Staffing Association president, as well as the Employment Trends representative. So thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Boquist.
Before you leave, madam,
Adam,
question.
Okay, come back. Sorry. I've never done this before. Can you tell?
You're doing great.
You're doing fine. As I understand it, you're the president of the Staffing Association?
The Oregon Staffing Association. We are the local chapter of ASA.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would have a suggestion, but, you know, I always get in trouble with my colleagues. So.
No, please do.
There's obviously a problem, and you know that. I think the people that aren't following the law are causing problems, and it's day staffing, and you've kind of heard the testimony here. I mean, I think it would be helpful, because we're not the experts up here, and we just sent it down to Legislative Council, never sends it down to Legislative Council, but if your organization has ideas on how to solve the problem, because there's a problem, mm-hmm. and they're competing against you, you get the bad name, your association does, the worker gets chipped out of their money, cheated, and everything else. So the question comes down is, because you guys deal with this on a day-to-day basis in your own business, is any suggestions you might have for committee members on how to focus down to solve the problem so it doesn't hurt legitimate businesses, and for once we hold illegitimate ones accountable.
Okay.
Thank you.
And if you could get together with Michael Dale as well as your representatives and see if there is any common ground, that would be much appreciated by the chair.
I will do that. Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really do appreciate you all coming down here. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 610, 611, and 624. And I will open a... Yeah. I will reopen a work session on Senate Bill 110 for the purposes of allowing Senator George to vote. Senator George, how do you vote?
Sure, I make that motion, please. Oh, thank you.
Right. I'm always a means guy.
Nice.
Do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I said the motion you just said.
Senator Boquist moves to allow Senator George to vote on Senate Bill 110.
Are you going to ask if there's any objection?
Is there any objection?
Unfortunately, the unemployment department has left, so that's
good.
I vote aye.
Okay. And Senator George votes aye. Please let the record reflect that on Senate Bill 110. So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 110, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 655. Could we bring up, I have four people down that would like to testify. Mr. Jama, Mr. Riley, Ms. Reed Guarnermo, and Sandra Hernandez. Do you all want to come up at the same time? Or individually.
I don't want to get out of the building because it's snowing like crazy in Portland. Like my committee administrator.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. I'm Andrew Riley. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We are a membership-based advocacy group of immigrants and refugees based in the Portland metro area. I'm here today to give you sort of a demographic overview very quickly about immigrants and refugees in Oregon, and then urge you to support Senate Bill 655, creating a Commission on Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. So just launching into the demographic piece, according to the 2008 American Community Survey, about 1 in 10 Oregonians is an immigrant. That's 9.7%, or about 350,000 people total. Now, this includes people who are lawful permanent residents, on the path to permanent residency, naturalized citizens, or people with refugee or asylum status. About 6.5% of our state's registered voters are new Americans. These are people who have gone through the process of naturalization and subsequently registered to vote. And if we look at economic data, again from the Census Bureau, in 2008, about 12% of our state's workforce was comprised of immigrants. And what I want to distill from this data is a pretty simple statement. Immigrants and refugees are a significant and significantly contributing part of our Oregon's population. We're not talking about some tiny niche group. We're talking about 1 in every 10 of our family members, friends, neighbors, 1 in every 10 of our fellow Oregonians. Despite this, the state has no body which looks at immigrant and refugee affairs within Oregon's borders, nor does any agency specifically look at the complex relationships these communities have with and within our state. Although sometimes disproportionately impacted by policy decisions or economic trends, we really don't have a deeper understanding of how these impacts play themselves out. And when I talk about disproportionate impacts, I want to be clear. Not every policy decision the state makes impacts different populations in different ways. You know, when we're talking about what our roads are made of, you know, your tires wear down at about the same rate no matter where you're from. But when we talk about the historical lack of standards for healthcare interpreters, we can certainly see how folks without a high degree of English fluency have had diminished access to effective healthcare, poorer individual health outcomes, and poorer population health as a whole. Luckily, to provide a snapshot of immigrant and refugee affairs in the state and increase community civic engagement at the same time, Oregon already has a model for a solution, and it's the Oregon Advocacy Commissions. Currently organized as a separate entity and housed in DAS, the four advocacy commissions on Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, Asian Affairs, and Women are supported by two administrative staff and offer the legislature and the governor the right tools to address community needs. These commissions engage community leaders as representatives who are able to advocate on behalf of their communities in an official capacity. The commission model gives these leaders a high degree of access to state agencies and positions them to advocate for smart policies to address disparities. SB 655 would create an advocacy commission structure in the same way, with the same mission, but specifically looking at immigrant and refugee affairs. Composed of 9 community members and 2 legislative liaisons from each chamber, or sorry, 1 from each chamber, 2 total, the commission would represent community needs in this state and submit a biennial report to the legislature and the governor detailing the needs of the community for the years ahead. And we at CIO have 2 main arguments about the need for this commission. First, it's about providing immigrants and refugees with the same degree of access to their government as any other Oregonian. And second, when immigrants and refugees comprise almost 10% of our state's population, it's time to ensure that we're working with this population in the most efficient and effective ways possible. So to conclude, SB 655 would create an advocacy commission on immigrant and refugee affairs. This commission would be able to provide a holistic understanding of how the community interacts with the state and within the state without breaking the bank. I urge you, members of the committee, to support this bill to ensure that we have the right tools to meet the challenges ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Kim.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Casey Chama. I am the Executive Director of the Center for Intercultural Organizing. Center for Intercultural Organizing is a grassroots organization working to build multiracial, multi-ethnic movement for immigrant refugee rights. We do this through public policy, intergenerational leadership development, community education, and community organizing. Before I start my core message, though, let me share with you some of my personal experience. I came to this great state of Oregon 12 years ago, not knowing anyone. I was physically and mentally exhausted from the impact of civil war and a refugee experience it had in my life. My transition from refugee to active member of our community was not an easy road. Trying to find a housing, employment, and medical care was daunting. I finally landed a job with one of the refugee resettlement organizations as a youth program coordinator and case manager. I had one mission in my mind, providing support for the refugee youth and their family so that they might make transition to a new system and new country easier for them, an opportunity that I had not have as a young man. Through this job, I interacted with many government agencies, including education system, healthcare, housing, and law enforcement. Through this experience, I quickly learned that many of our state system and policies needed to change in order to work for newcomers, communities, and immigrant refugees. Immigrant refugees must have a way to effectively engage with the state in their issues. Currently, no single entity exists to examine how public policy impacts immigrant refugees. No unified voice in our state government that can strategize with lawmakers and effectively integrate growing immigrant refugee community or shine a light where duplication of services exist. Senate Bill 655 will create a Commission of Immigrant Refugee Affairs. The commission will work, as my Andrew said, already the existing commissioners, like Commission of Black Affairs and Commission of Hispanic Affairs and Commission of Asian Affairs, Commission of Women and others. But it will study how immigrants and refugees interact with the state business and nonprofits here in Oregon. The commission will also have one state senator, one state representative, and 9 immigrant refugees from different places and backgrounds. It will write a report, as we said, with the recommendation every 2 years about the state and immigrant refugees here in Oregon. I strongly believe that the future of our state and its prosperity depends on how well we integrate our immigrant refugee community. It's imperative that our state legislatures and the governor have a commission on immigrant refugee affairs that can assist tackling the challenges and opportunities that the new migration brings. The Commission of Immigrant Refugee Affairs could bring lawmakers best practices and cutting-edge public policy solutions on immigrant refugee issues. We don't want to miss out the creativity and ingenuity of 10% of our state's thriving cultures. Therefore, we need to develop tools that will allow us truly to welcome our newcomers. I believe the proposed Senate Bill 655 has the potential to simultaneously impact the social, political, and economic conditions of our immigrant refugee community in Oregon. But immigrants and refugees are less likely to build the power they need to create a positive change by working isolation from one another and from the mainstream institutions. By establishing Commission of Immigrant Refugee Affairs, designed and led by the individuals and the community impacted by this issue, we will finally connect the dots. Let us choose opportunity from scarcity, interconnectedness from isolation, and equity over inequality. Let us be the visionaries we need so that Oregon can be welcoming, pluralistic, and inclusive for all. Thank you.
Well done. Thank you, colleagues, for hanging in there. We have one more person to testify, I believe. Ms. Hernandez.
I'll be quick. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me today. My name is Sandra Hernandez. Mr. Chair and everyone in this committee, thank you very much for your time. I'm here to testify on behalf of in support of Senate Bill 655. So I am the director of the Tree Institute, which is one of the co-founders of the People of Color Health Equity Immigrants and Refugees Collaborative, and also CHARLA, Collective Health Advocacy for Rooted Latinos and Africans. We have been working together for about, the last 2 years already in these several issues related with health, and especially in the health reform. And I would like to testify quickly about two moments that I have been being myself in situations as an immigrant as well. I'm sorry.
You're doing great.
That I really care and I consider the importance of this commission to be created and that allows more space and ways of navigating through the government structure. So when I came here 13 years ago as an international student, first at the University of Washington, the state of Washington, there was, even though already accepted by the university and, you know, going through the whole, you know, natural process that we have to go, everything, still I found so much lack of support and difficulties to go to, you know, to really pursue to my graduate studies. And I started learning about the whole, you know, system in the United States and understanding better how we do in different states. Then I thought, well, maybe that could be just specifically, you know, one educational institution. However, when I moved to Portland 4 years ago and started really working closer with our immigrants and refugees in Latino communities, I came to realize that really what Mr. Casey Jama and Andrew is talking about, and all of our colleagues, that we don't have that much space in the government structures, you know, in committees, and it's really hard to have some access. So I believe this kind of commission would allow us to, you know, work in more equity basis than as much as other communities. It's just a way of making sure we are open and as an open society that we are and how much we can work together. So I really thank you for attention. I hope we can work together on this idea.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Brown-Dimitri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a brief comment. I'm sorry I missed the name of the first person who testified.
I'm Andrew Riley. You mentioned something about the ACS numbers, which I'm familiar with as the chair of the redistricting committee, and I just wanted to let you and the committee members know that the U.S. Census numbers arrived in Oregon today, and so we will have updated information about the percentage of all the different details about where people are living and the demographics. So if you're interested in those numbers, you can contact me or the committee staff. Those are being uploaded as we speak. So if you're interested in more information, those will be more current figures than ACS numbers.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Does anybody else like to speak on Senate Bill 655? All right, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 655. We've got to wait for the fiscal statement to come back. I anticipate this will have some cost, and it will likely be referred down to Ways and Means, depending on what the Legislative Fiscal Office tells us the cost would be. And that's Senate Bill 14. Regarding Senate Bill 14, we just did get the dash one as a courtesy to some of the members that would like to consider the amendments. We will roll that over. I would like to have some conversations with the Treasurer's Office and the people who want to amend it, the Oregon Bankers Association, in my office before the next hearing on Monday, if at all possible. So any other comments for the good of the order? Thanks for sticking in there with me, colleagues. This committee meeting is adjourned.